Good morning, everybody. Welcome to this session on the Practitioner's Guide for Advancing Health Equity. I am Leslie Mickelson, and I'm here representing Sandra Vieira, who unfortunately was not able to attend. And I'm joined here by Dr. Patty Tucker from CDC. We will be the presenters today. Unfortunately, our other presenters were not able to attend, but we are hoping that that will provide us a real opportunity for a great discussion about health equity. So, welcome. I wanted to just maybe start off sharing an experience I had working for the food bank of Alameda County. I'm actually a public health nutritionist by training. That was my work before coming to Prevention Institute. If I went around to food programs and to people standing in food lines and asked them about what needed to be done about hunger in our community, the answer I got was, we need more food programs. If I asked people, why are people standing in line for food, I got a completely different answer. People said, oh, well, the rents here have skyrocketed. Or my family had a medical emergency and we had to spend all our cash on medical expenses. Or childcare, another really expensive family aspect of the family budget. So I learned from that, because we were starting a hunger education and advocacy program in our county, that it's really important how we think and analyze the health issues we're trying to solve. And it was really important to present a frame that was about these underlying community issues that were leading families to end up not having enough money for food, in order to develop an effective strategy to prevent hunger in our county. And I feel that the work in health equity that we're presenting here today really grows out of that, the knowledge, I think, that we really do have as public health practitioners to go upstream and to think about the root causes of illness and injury, and then to really plan community strategies that get at those community factors that are driving poor health. I'm going to present a framework and an overview of how Prevention Institute, we do training around the country and technical assistance, as well as doing work in our own communities in Southern California and in California around health equity and around especially chronic disease prevention, which is the focus of our talk today. So I'll present the framework, and then happily, we were very happy to be invited by CDC to help support the production of a practitioner's guide for addressing health equity that really highlights strategies related to tobacco, food, and activity. And so I'm really happy to be sharing the podium with Dr. Tucker today. This is Prevention Institute here in Oakland, and we really want to see every place in the country have a Prevention Institute. We know, we have the knowledge on how to prevent illness and injury, so we think it is only common sense in our society when right now so much resource is flowing to healthcare, so much is being lost within families and within workplaces for people being sick, children aren't learning well, we are committed to going upstream to promote quality prevention practice. Health disparities, this definition, it's the differences in the incidence, prevalence, mortality, and burden of diseases and other adverse health conditions exist among specific populations. So this is the technical definition. We are very happy to present today that we are going beyond this definition. We're not just talking about health disparities. We are now talking about health inequities and, in fact, about health equity. It's not just some statistics about a gap. We are talking about how do we really build a society where everyone has access to what they need to be healthy and to reach their fullest potential. Let me share some really, you've probably seen this analysis, but I want to share it today in the spirit of how do we start to talk in our communities about equity in an effective way. So I'm going to share an analysis done in Oakland, California by the Alameda County Public Health Department. And they did an analysis looking at an African-American child growing up in the Flatlands, which is the lower-income areas of Oakland, compared to a white child growing up in the hills, a more wealthy, affluent part of Oakland. And what did they find? A 15-year difference in life expectancy. And in fact, they found that in addition to doing the years difference, which you've probably seen around the country, they also did an analysis by income level. So regardless of where kids lived, for every $12,500 in family income, they saw one additional year of life expectancy. So we could really document the difference between where people live. And that leads us to say the health inequities we see are not just about individual bad choices, they are about things not being fair. And what we want to do is dig into and look at what accounts for that big difference in place. This is a campaign done called Health Happens in Neighborhoods by the California Endowment, and it shows very graphically, these are billboards they put around all over California, the difference by zip code of life expectancy, a 15-year difference in life expectancy by zip code. Between these two communities that they compared, 95219 and 92657, and I will tell you that they put up these billboards in communities where people know what those two zip codes signify. I want to share this. I think it's very, this meant a lot to me. I'm going to actually go back for a second because I want to read it to you as it comes up. Oh, Convergence Partnership, which is a funders collaborative we help support, supported photo voice projects in a number of six communities around the country. And it was youth that were looking at how to both address violence in their communities, which was a really top of mind issue, and at the same time to really address chronic disease. And I'm going to share with you a few of the photo voice slides. So the first one, and these are the youth titled them, Diabetes on a Shelf. So many different companies see the people in our neighborhood as just a way to get paid, so they don't really care about us. It is evident, seeing how easily they provide us with unhealthy food that will likely end up with us in the hospital with a disease or dead, unless we do something about it. Javon Jones, 17 years old. Another observation. I see a basketball in a busy street. It's sad in our neighborhood. We don't have anywhere to play, or they play near the streets. Those kids could really get hurt. This is a problem because this puts kids in danger. A way to fix this is to build more parks or recreation centers so that kids don't have somewhere safe, so that kids have somewhere safe to play. This one I happen to know is from Santa Ana, California, and see what Daisy Romero said about this field. We could see this place as a place to play sports. We don't get to interact as much because we don't have places to play. The bond is broken. We could build a park so that kids my age can stay active, healthy, and connected. I just can't even share with you better evidence about the inequalities we have between neighborhoods and the real opportunity for communities to work together for change. I mean, these youth are ready, and they're taking action in their communities. One thing that I think has been a really important evolution that I've seen in public health during my career, which now spans 25 years, is, you know, when I was studying public health and we talked about the environment, people usually meant air, water, and soil. and how toxins in air, water, and soil impacted health outcomes. Well, we have had now nearly 25 years of really building the case about how the environment shapes behavior. So when we talk about behavior problems, quote unquote, whether we're talking about alcohol use, tobacco, unhealthy eating habits, sedentary behavior, we can always take a step back to think about what are the community factors that are really shaping those behaviors. Those behaviors don't just emerge out of a vacuum. And our sense as an institution, and I think we've been really thrilled to work with CDC on creating the playbook that really got at some of these community strategies, is if we want to improve health across the population, and that, after all, is our charge in public health, we are going to have to start to look at these community factors. So let me just go through a little bit of a framework we use to, again, to help explain this and help folks see the importance of these upstream factors. And one thing I want to mention is there is really, really, really good research base now behind what are those community factors. We did a lit review and have published our work under a grant from the Office of Minority Health, U.S. Office of Minority Health, but others have done similar work. And really the factors that come up are pretty similar. We have to look at the place factors, you know, that's the built environment, everything from the exposure to toxins to the look, feel, and safety to what's sold and how it's promoted. All these factors impact health outcomes, as do the opportunity factors. Do people have jobs? Do they have education? And are they living in a community where they're not facing bias and discrimination based on race, gender, or other factors? And then finally, there are the people factors. We know having relationships, ability to work with your fellow community residents to make change, that those factors too improve health outcomes. Now we actually have all the science on cortisol levels, which I think is really, really important. Because it basically now scientific, put it this way, I think it's important in the world we live in of public health and medicine, because it now puts science behind the notion that stress, and that's the stress of poverty, the stress of facing discrimination, the stress of our busy work lives, that is actually impacting our health. And finally, of course, we do need to acknowledge healthcare services are important, that we do have some advances in medicine that can help through early detection, help people have better health outcomes, and we certainly want to ensure that everyone who needs them has access to affordable healthcare services. But it's really those place, people, and opportunity factors that are the opportunity for prevention. So that when I use the word environment up there, that stands for community environments, and that stands for people, place, opportunity factors. So that's our key opportunity for prevention. And after all, we really do, as much as possible, want to take advantage of the fact that we know how to prevent illness and injury. We know how to prevent health inequities. We do have to go, we have a long way to go to create the political will to do that, and I want to acknowledge that, but I think all of us here in this room want to be part of our national movement for eliminating health inequities and promoting health equity. So here's a definition. This is one we use in our office. What is health equity? It's the attainment of the highest level of health for all people. And achieving health equity requires valuing everyone equally with focused and ongoing societal efforts to address avoidable inequalities, historical and contemporary injustices, and the elimination of health and healthcare disparities. So that we like to use a very global definition of health equity, and to really have the solution as part of our definition. Now I want to talk a little bit about chronic disease, and I'm going to share this framework I mentioned, the two steps to prevention. It's kind of incredible. When you look at why healthcare costs escalated in this country, it's mostly about chronic disease. 75% of our national health expenditures are for chronic disease treatment. And I can say as a nutritionist, it saddens me because I know that many, many people in this country don't have access to healthy food. I know that we have an environment that is constantly promoting unhealthy eating habits, whether it's through marketing or through the fact that cheap, high-calorie, relatively low nutrient food is what's easily available in neighborhoods, and that the large portion sizes are what everybody expects. I mean, for all those reasons, just if we take nutrition alone, we are not doing our best to promote health outcomes. Institute of Medicine, it is unreasonable to expect that people will change their behavior easily when so many forces in the social, cultural, and physical environment conspire against such change. So if anybody says, well, where's the evidence that working on community makes a difference, just use this quote. It's an Institute of Medicine report, an authoritative source. I can't see the publication date from here, but it's almost at least a decade old. So it's a great piece of data.
2000.
Thank you, 2000. But as some of you may know, Brian Smedley from the Joint Center, who's now created a new organization, helped work on this report. So here's our two steps, finally. And we found that this is a good way to help people understand how do you move up to the environment. So one way to think about it is take a disease, right? And that's where most of the discussions about health start. They start with a disease like diabetes, of course. Many people are talking about what do we do about type 2 diabetes? It's horrible. Now we have kids getting it. When you ask someone what to do about it, the first thing people think about is healthcare. And of course we want to assure people have access to affordable health care. And I actually think this is very analogous to the food bank example I gave you of when you first ask people what to do about hunger and they're standing in the food line, they say more food lines. Well, so in our country, people are used to thinking of health care as the solution for health concerns. And of course we want to make sure if someone's diagnosed that they do get the best treatment possible in a culturally appropriate manner. Absolutely. But we have to recognize medical care alone is not going to solve this problem, right? It's not going to change the statistics of population health because it's not the primary determinant of health. It's only reaching one person at a time. And it often comes late. When people are getting in for medical care, there may already be damage that's been done in their body. So if we want to do prevention, or we want to even do a much, much better job of chronic disease management, we have to take the first step. And the first step is to acknowledge exposures and behaviors have a big impact on health outcomes. Like these boys, sedentary behavior, you know, a risk factor for type 2 diabetes. And this analysis, going from the illnesses and injuries, I don't want to forget injuries, to risk factors, was really done by McGinnis and Fay in this article they wrote called Actual Causes of Death. Right? And they did a great job of showing that we could really account for the major leading causes of death by going back to a whole set of actual causes. And this doesn't list all of them. It lists some of the prominent ones, diet and activity patterns, tobacco, alcohol, and drugs. In this article, they also mentioned social and economic factors, and they also mentioned infectious disease. So this is our first step to get to prevention, is to recognize with chronic disease, of course, we're talking primarily about food, activity, and tobacco, though we know alcohol also has an impact. So that's our first step to prevention. But if we're going to design community strategy, again, often when people think about, and I can say I was trained as a public health nutritionist, what to do about eating habits, the first thing that I was taught was, oh, you do nutrition counseling. You work with people one-on-one. Or you hand them you work really hard on a really great brochure. Well, I wish that worked. If it worked, people would eat a lot better. But when there's all this community environment pushing people towards unhealthy habits, information is important, and I think everybody deserves accurate information. And I think, I do want to acknowledge that the food industry often puts out very confusing, false information about health. So I think it's really good to have nutrition professionals who can help people on an individual basis, but it's not enough. It's not going to change the patterns of illness and injury across the community. We also have to take a second step, and that is to the environment. Why are those boys sitting in and watching video games? Is it because the local park is closed? What's the reason? Let's ask ourselves, what is the reason? Or do they have amazing parks and open space in their community with not only the parks and open space, but great activity programming? And we've got research now to show you really need both to maximize physical activity levels across the community. So again, when we talk about health inequities and how do we really address them and how do we really break up this pattern that goes from the environment to exposures to toxic substances, unhealthy behaviors, to healthcare services, which unfortunately we know are not always accessible. And in fact, we know through unequal burden, an important IOM report, that people of color and low-income folks, uneducated, less educated folks, do not always receive top treatment, even when they have access to healthcare. That's how we get these inequities in illness and injury, and we want to go back to this key opportunity for prevention. So I'm going to turn things over to Patty in a moment, but I did want to let you know that we have a Prevention Institute resources on our website. The Health Equity and Prevention Primer is actually a self-guided course. It's free. I'm pretty sure you can get health education credits for this, CHESS credits for this, and it covers in much more depth the material I shared with you. We also have our Thrive tool for health and resilience in vulnerable environments that is designed as an assessment tool that communities can use to look at those place, people, and opportunity factors and to think together about what are the areas they most want to focus on to promote health equity in their community. I will let you know on Thrive that the most updated materials are not on our website. So if you're interested in getting more information about Thrive or our other health equity materials, please do give me your card, and I can also follow up with an email. And then finally, I wanted to mention that we are incredibly proud to have been invited by CDC to help support them in the development of the Practitioner's Guide to Health Equity. A little bit of the genesis of this, and I hope, Patty, I'm not stealing your story, but I was part of the TA team for communities putting prevention to work. And some of you may have been involved with, was anybody involved with CPPW, as it was fondly called? No, okay. Then let me just take 1 second to say that it was the first really large investment by the federal government, and it was with the support of the president and of the Senate, Senator Tom Harkin, to really invest in community prevention focused on policy systems and environmental change. And we were very excited to be a part of that. I'd say we also, as part of the TA team working very closely with CDC, I think that there emerged a recognition that there needed to be more resource that was really devoted and thinking about what does it take to promote equity. And that is how the idea of the Health Equity Prevention Primer came to be. So now I will turn things over to Dr. Patty Tucker from CDC. Thank you so much.